When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey there, and welcome to Time to Lean, the podcast where you air your dirty laundry and we help you clean up your shit. I'm Crystal Britt.
And I'm Laura Danger. Think of us as your household secret weapon, taking your questions and voicemails to navigate the wild world of gender norms and household dynamics.
We dive headfirst into the nitty-gritty of how broader social issues impact our everyday lives.
So don't be shy, send us your dirty laundry.
And we'll help you clean up your shit.
This is Time to Lean.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Time to Lean. I'm Crystal Britt. This is Laura Danger. How are you, Laura? How's your day going?
Doing all right. Doing all right. Ready for my afternoon coffee.
I'm ready. Yeah, for sure. I feel that hard.
Yeah. How are you? You just getting to the bottom of yours, huh?
Literally. And this is my first cup because it is morning over here. So I need to get my shit together. I'm behind.
Catch up. Okay, everybody, welcome. I sent out a survey to followers about a year ago and got a whole bunch of anonymous responses. And I'm going to share with you one of the prompts because it is a prompt that somebody sent us. And I basically tossed it right back to everybody else. Like, hey, give me your thoughts. Give me your feelings. It was very open-ended. So I'm going to read this and we're going to talk about it.
Love it.
Okay, it says, I thought being independent made me strong. I sacrificed myself until I had no idea who I was anymore. I felt guilty if I couldn't manage it all or be everything to everyone. So I just kept doing more, resenting myself and my family along the way. I was a wife and a mother, but who was I? Relatable?
Yeah, very relatable. I'm kind of trying to figure out which part of that to start with. First of all, I feel like it is so relatable and exactly, I'm hesitant to say that I don't know any mothers who have not experienced this, but I'm sure there's got to be a couple, but it's so universal. I feel like I talk about hyper independence and lone wolf syndrome in sessions and with my own therapist all the time. So that's hardcore relatable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. I definitely see myself, like, if I get hurt or resentful in any way, I'm the kind of person who will just like withdraw.
Yeah.
And I'm like, or here's a really fun habit, really, really fun maladaptive thing I do. When I have a strong connection, I immediately am like, oh, I'm going to let them down. Oh, they're going to, oh yeah. Nope. I'm going to go ahead and lower the expectations on that one. So it's like a really fun roller coaster of like, I'm going to pull back and be really independent, or I'm going to pull back and just like make sure that they don't rely on me because I'm, and not in a like selfish way, but in a like, no, I don't want to, I'm going to definitely fuck this up. And then I fuck it up. That's what I do. It's really fun. Self-sabotage.
Okay. Okay. This is so interesting. So not to, I don't, you let me know when I cross a therapy line. Okay. You let me know where the line's at. Okay. So this is so interesting because I've been talking with clients, or like, I guess thinking about when I'm in session with clients, the concept of self-sabotage, I don't, as a neurodivergent person, I don't resonate with. And so I kind of try and take this is going to sound weird, but like a strengths-based perspective of self-sabotage, because I don't know that there are, it's weird to me to feel like, because our brains are self-protective, that we're constantly working toward, our brains are constantly working toward like a homeostasis, even if it's in maladaptive ways. Self-sabotage doesn't make any sense to me. So what I ask instead is, what purpose does like pulling back and being like, what purpose does pulling back serve for you? So like for you, Laura, like what purpose does pulling back serve?
It's self-protective. It's like a secure. I feel secure if I don't rely on anyone, because I don't want that, because I'm like, that could disappear. That could hurt. And if I don't rely on it and no one relies on me, then, because I don't want to hurt anyone and I don't want to be hurt. And so it's like, you know what's so funny is when we watch Clay on Love is Blind, when I tell you, this is so funny, I'm like really airing my dirty laundry right now. I recently found like a hard drive of mine from 2000, whatever. I have like a bunch of stuff stored in a drive. And I found like 5 transcripts from AIM messages.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine the time capsule?
Oh, I have those printed out somewhere. I don't have them on a hard drive, but I definitely have those printed out. Yeah.
And this was like, I don't know. I have had, I think, 2 of the like 5 conversations. At some point, I'm like, I told you I was trouble. Like,
that's the best. That's the best thing I've heard all day. Because how old are you? 15, 16, 14, 15, 16?
Yeah. I'm like, I
told you I was bad news.
Uh-huh. It was like, well, and like for anybody who is just learning, I'm 35, so I got diagnosed with bipolar 2 in the end of 2020. Anyway, not long ago. And so I have dealt with ADHD, substance abuse issues, substance abuse from when I was like 12, 13, and like depressive episodes, like very dangerous, debilitating, depressive, and hypomanic. Now I'm finding out episodes my entire life. And so when I tell you I thought I was the manic pixie dream girl, and I was just like living out that fantasy. And so when I did something like quirky, or I was just like, I'm a dark, mysterious
I'm an enigma. Yeah, absolutely.
This DM is so funny. And he like, it's the guy I had a crush on, who kissed me when we were watching Fraggle Rock one time.
Classic makeout movie. Show.
But he was like, you're trouble. And I was like, I told you I was trouble. But when I see people who like Clay, who's like, I'm so worried I can't take care of you type of thing. Like, I've done that. I've been like, I'm going to hurt you. I'm troubled. Like, back off. But also, and like doing all of the things like, I want to be with you. Oh, but also, no, don't. So,
right. Yes. And here's the other thing too, that is so, it's so interesting. I was the opposite of that. Like, what is the absolute, what's the, if manic pixie dream girl is that, I was always the mom of the, like, I was always the mom. I was always the mom. The way I got so pissed off when Chelsea Ruff got the superlative of most likely to become a soccer mom, and I knew I had the votes. I thought I had the votes secured. Senior year was unreal how mad I was about that for like a long time. Chelsea's a wonderful person now, by the way. But it's that thing of that hyper independence, I think, as well serves a purpose. Like you said, it's a defense mechanism to protect yourself from being hurt, right? Really interesting to hear you say that it's also a protection against me hurting other people, because to an extent we have control over that. But the people that usually cause the most harm in relationships are people who don't consider that they might be hurting someone else, or don't give a shit, right? Or like not interested in reflecting on whether or not they're hurting someone else. So I think that it is like a double-edged sword, that hyper-independence and that like lone wolf kind of syndrome. But I do feel like for a lot of people who are socialized as female, that's a very normal, it's a very not normal feeling. It's a very familiar feeling to be like, things are getting kind of like dicey here. I don't know if it's okay for me to talk to you about this or if you're going to receive this well. So I'm just going to go ahead and pull back. Like, I'm just going to go ahead and like go very inward and introspective and not bring this up, because I can probably figure it out. That's what I see most in sessions is, hey, are you solving this because you want to solve it and your partner is helping you solve it? Or are you solving it because you know you have the well-developed and well-honed skills of accepting responsibility that doesn't belong to you? It's easier to control.
So, Oh, yeah. It's real scary. I mean, that's the other part of emotional labor. And not as like, I don't know the ins and outs of overfunctioning, underfunctioning, all that stuff. But like, yeah, it takes 2 to tango, and giving endlessly or self-sacrificing and martyring is just as emotionally, like, it's just as much of an avoidance of vulnerability as like, it's a defense.
Yes. And to this responder's point, it's as much of an avoidance of what you have to face, because that self-sacrificial and that like martyrdom of motherhood kind of thing, always the price is always your identity. I haven't met a person where the price was not their identity, right? Where they're like, no, like I feel pretty strongly about how well I, you know, fused my individual identity as a person with motherhood. I'm pretty happy with that. It's usually they hit a wall where they're like, I don't know who I am outside of being a mother. And that's really upsetting. And then it's like, okay, so now how do we rebuild that? How do we start to figure out who you are again?
And that's okay. That's the other tricky thing. And maybe I have some answers here. And okay, I think this person said, I gave up my dreams to support his. I didn't even realize I was doing it until years later. I felt guilty when I couldn't, quote, help him be successful, when I couldn't get him more work, which he relied on me to do. He often says he could do more so I could work less and not worry if I just helped him get more work. It makes me feel like a failure. I'm so far removed from my passions that sometimes I feel passionless. And then he will have to point out that I have no interests. Sometimes it feels like his needs stole them. But hold on. I want to say, maybe I have like a bunch of notes here. Somebody said, like, it isn't that I don't resent motherhood. I don't resent the chores at all. Like, I actually really, really enjoy that work. It's the fact that I am doing them alone against my will. That's not what I don't have a problem cooking. I don't have a problem cleaning. These are things I enjoy doing. And somebody was like, it's what makes our life good and comfortable. And I care about it. Mm. And it's that somebody else doesn't care about them in the same way or doesn't see the cost that it has on me. That is what hurts.
Okay. See, with that, like, I can understand I enjoy doing those things, except for when they're like demanded or expected of me. The part I have a hard time understanding is where in that scenario, that person says it's actually the not seeing the cost that it takes for me. Like, can you enjoy something and it cost you something dearly?
Yes.
Like, I can understand doing something and then not being appreciated for it and not being told this is a dual purpose. I enjoy cooking and also it provides a function for the rest of our family, like for you and the rest of our family. And I would love to be appreciated for it. I get that. I can get that. But in this scenario, to say I enjoy doing this thing, but I also I want to be appreciated for what it costs me to do this labor intensive thing is harder for me to connect. And maybe that's just because of the way it's worded or because of the way my brain works. They're not mutually exclusive.
I think that what I get from that is like, not, you aren't recognizing the cost it has that I'm doing it on my own.
Got it. The emotional cost of being alone and doing it.
Yeah. From others, what I gather similar is just like, I'm doing it for your benefit and I'm not, it's the fact that it's not reciprocated.
Yes.
Like that part you're not recognizing. And that's, I hear that all of the time, which is like, I'm happy to support you. I want to support you. That was never the issue. The issue is not that you need me to pack you a lunch. I'm happy to pack you a lunch. I love cleaning your clothes. These are things I just really, I don't like. Like, folding is kind of burdensome. And it's kind of annoying and the trash smells and all that. But like, these are acts of care. They are showing appreciation of you feeling healthy. And this was a really huge internal messaging for me because I supported my husband. I supported Jack through starting his own business and eagerly, happily wanting him to do these things and traveling. But then him being away for 10 days and being like, this is really hard. And it was a tough spot where I was like, I don't feel, because of the way that this has slipped into inequity, I don't feel like I can also go away for 10 days.
That's a really good example. Yeah. Because of the way that it's set up and because of the way I have provided support, now the dynamic in household is set up in a way where I'm invaluable and I can't leave. Yeah.
Right. That was always like, that was something that I had to figure out how to verbalize for a long time. And to myself, like, I had to understand and be like, I'm fully, fully committed to behaving the way I am behaving. Mm-hmm. And also it's not right. Like, this is not, it's off. This is off. And being able I didn't know how to communicate that. Yeah. Because I'd be like, well, I can't go away for 10 days. And he'd be like, do you want to? I'd be like, no. And so it's just like,
okay, but, yeah.
And it's like, okay, the word autonomy,
yeah,
like choice, empowerment. Like I needed to be able to think about how to say these things.
Yeah.
And like that for me was a social conditioning thing where I was like, I think I had bought in unintentionally or like deep in me that like, if you're working outside the house, that is reciprocity. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I didn't ask for certain things.
Right.
And he didn't know how to do them. And we didn't, that was not a framework we knew.
Right. That you, it was because you guys had a different framework at that time. I'm also mm-hmm. wondering how, like, as you're talking about this, I'm also trying to reflect on, because Ben did build his own business for about 7 years, commission only based, like very paycheck to paycheck kind of situation. And it was a slog for both of us. When I tell you that the way I am still deconstructing, and not because he set it up this way, right? But because of the unexamining that we both had a hand in, the way that I still struggle with, no, I continue to support, and I did support for so many years, the building of that business. So like, if we need a new refrigerator, we need to talk about, like, I need to, like, I don't need to feel guilty about that. Like, it's a very weird spot to be in of like, no, my, and I think one of our close friends who's like a, you know, like an uncle to our kids pointed that out where he was like, Crystal, you made that possible. And I was mm-hmm. like, that's weird because I don't feel like I did anything. You know, like I don't feel like I have a right to, I don't even know, to say I want a break or to say, hey, our bed is real fucking lumpy and I would like for us to buy a new bed. Like, I feel like that's indulgent of me or selfish of me to be like, I have needs and wants and whatever. It's a very weird, and I feel like a lot of it I blocked out. Like, honestly, like yeah. when I try and pull from my own experience, I'm like, I feel like I blacked out for 10 years and it's hard to go back.
Yeah. You know, what's really challenging. I hear from a lot of women specifically, this is very much like the heteronormative framework and capitalists look at work and whose labor matters, but they'll be stay-at-home parents for a really long time. They will not get a college degree when they get married because it's a better investment in the long run to get the husband to get the degree.
Mm-hmm.
It's just smart, you know,
like right.
it's better for the family and right. everybody does their part. And then it's that messaging. Like, this is where I feel like it sometimes slips into like financial abuse and
yes. yep.
emotional neglect where it's like, well, this is my money.
Right.
This is my money. I have all this stuff. Like, you are being ungrateful or like you have to ask for it and things like that. I've talked to a lot of people who will get to a point where they're like, I can't leave. I don't have health insurance. I can't yep. find housing. And I don't have any kind of training because
yeah.
I supported yes. him through that.
Yep.
And they will leave. And in a custody issue, that will be very, God. Very painful. And in alimony will be, again, very, very painful. And even later, for the rest of their lives as a divorced person, will hear shit talk about mm-hmm. how they were money grabbers. They didn't, all they're going to do is bleed you dry for money for the rest right. of your life.
Right. They were just, it's they really were opportunists. Sad. Like mm-hmm. you planned it that way.
Right.
And that's not even taking into consideration whatever family culture ideas, whatever like religious ideas you have around those kinds of things. Like, those can very easily slip into that like extra justification of like, yeah, I mean, it just like doesn't make logical or financial sense for me to continue to finish this degree because he's going to get paid more and I'm going to stay home with the mm-hmm. kids. So like that's saving us money. And it's like, okay. Like it's a very, yeah, that's a very interesting, sticky place to, like you said, goes into writing that line of financial abuse, emotional neglect, like all of those things.
Yeah. Well, and if anybody hasn't read Hood Feminism by Mickey Kendall, she had a baby. I think she left her first marriage when the baby was like one.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in a situation where she used a lot of public resources. And that really, really informed her work as understanding like social resources, things like mm-hmm. access to food, education, and housing as an equality and a feminist issue.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, policing and the way that policing in general, the criminal justice system is not just and hurts women just as much as it hurts everybody else. So yeah, I guess I kind of went on it. And everybody else that I've talked to like for writing this book, a ton of people, I have all of these surveys and interviews and everything, like consistently I hear that having a model of somebody doing it or someone getting through it can be mm-hmm. just absolutely life-saving. These resources that you can get access to, we have a list of them on our website and we always recommend like the Fresh Starts Registry. If you're in a situation like if you can talk to your doctor mm-hmm. and your doctor will probably be able to connect you with resources.
That's a really good point.
But she had, so yeah, I bring it back to Mickey Kendall though. She ended up getting a degree. She's an author. She has gone on to do all sorts of amazing things from public housing. And like she saw the benefits of it and took that leap and understood, you know, not that it's easy. I think we say those things because it's like having a model and knowing that it's a thing and can happen.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because when you have the model, you have a template to work on, to work from. Like getting my master's degree was not based on a template of anticipating that it wasn't well thought through enough for me to be like, well, I want this just in case something ever goes south with this relationship. I got that degree because I watched my mom, who had just gotten her master's degree and gotten divorced and was able to support herself, right? And then my grandmother, who didn't have that and had to work three jobs, right? Like I had templates to work off of to know, no, this is just smart. Like, this isn't me preparing for the worst. This is just intelligent, right? Like having those, if I didn't have those, I very easily could have modeled just what was around me at college, like the people, the mentors that I had. I would not have gotten a degree. I would not have even gotten my bachelor's degree. I would not have been able to plan that far ahead.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to read one of these because I think it's really, okay. In that prompt, I got this. Yeah, motherhood strips you of your identity. I definitely mourned my pre-motherhood life, and I feel like that grief needs to be normalized. That's all that's there. That's the whole response. And that was in response to like, I thought being independent made me strong. I sacrificed myself. I resented myself and my family. I was a wife, a mother. Who was I? And saying, yeah, motherhood strips you of your identity. That doesn't land well for me.
Say, can you read it one more time?
Yeah, motherhood strips you of your identity. I definitely mourned my pre-motherhood life, and I feel like that grief needs to be normalized.
I think that's an incomplete thought. Like, yes, I went through three distinct phases in motherhood, right? I became a mother and very quickly was hit like a car into a brick wall. Oh shit, like my whole life is going to be different. And there is a before baby and an after baby situation. I got to grieve the before life, right? Then it was the deep dive into this is what I'm doing. This is who I'm going to be, right? The full force, like what is my, you know, personal brand of motherhood? And now, right? Like post 20, or I would even say 29, because I went back when I started to like, be like, I want to figure out my own career and I want to have my own like therapy practice that belongs to me because I want something that belongs to me. That was that's this whole phase of like, how do I integrate being a mother as part of my life and not who I am as a person, right? Because I don't want that. I don't want that trajectory for any of my kids in parenthood, if that's what they choose to do. Right?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I think that's what landed poorly for me. Because I think that a lot of other people, when I had a baby, I was young. Nobody who was like hanging out with me for my 20s. And you were, oh my God, 24?
I was 25 because my baby was born in January. And then 26, I was going to be off of the insurance. So that's how my mom's insurance. So that's how we planned that out. Because my birthday's in February. So I was about to turn 26 when I had my first kid. Yeah.
Well, that's wild. You're a baby.
I was baby.
You were a baby. I think I was 27.
That's still baby. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Or 28. I don't know. I'm 35. So yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like 28.
Yeah.
What was I? My brain blank.
Brain smooth, head empty. Got it.
Yeah. So when I was going through that, I want to say like maybe two other people that I was relatively close with had babies around the same time. And everyone was like, we all had our own careers. And like one of my friends became a stay-at-home parent. I kind of went down to part-time because of some health complications with mine. And then the other one like took a promotion and doubled her salary and seemed to be absolutely thriving, which was really hard for me to see because she would say the same things I was saying. And we would all say the same things. This is really hard. Like, wow, it's a lot. Also, I'm loving it. And watching her just like say it was hard and then like girl boss, you know?
Yeah.
And then like seeing my other friend and just being like, I love this tender moments at home.
You're like, y'all are having tender moments at home?
But it was like, I felt very alone. I felt very alone. I felt like I understood it was hard, but I felt like it was harder for me. Like I was doing something wrong.
Yeah.
And that in some ways that was grief that was normalized. Like everyone was like, yeah, you're totally different. So I just thought like that kind of misery, that's a strong word, That kind of like,
I mean, if like reflecting on early motherhood, those first, like, I mean, the first year, like if that's not what it is, I mean, I had postpartum depression. So if that's not what it is, yeah. So it is, I mean, it is misery. It's the thing of I'm trying so hard and I'm treading water and I'm partially choking on water because I'm drowning and I'm doing it wrong, clearly. And people around you are like, yeah. Motherhood's hard. And you're like, oh, what the fuck? Like, I got to get this reality to be normal. Like, I've got to accept this reality as soon as possible because maybe that will make it easier.
Yes.
And that's the kind of
grief. Right. Yeah. And that's the kind of grief. Like, I don't want that to be normalized. That's the specific kind of grief that is normalized for American women. And I think, like, probably like globally, but like the like isolated. I mean, even, you know, I've interviewed and talked with my friend had a lot of postpartum. I have a lot of postpartum support through family nearby. There's the like Eastern tradition of lying in 40 days of lying in where you basically just like rest and are tended to. You don't even shower. You're not supposed to, air quotes for supposed, but like your body is taking care of you. You're supposed to stay warm, eat certain foods, all this. Like the cold, hard truth of Western white capitalist motherhood is just like, good fucking luck. Cry it out.
Cry it out and then be given at your 6-week appointment a pamphlet of, and I think maybe we haven't talked about this here, but like pamphlet of what to watch for postpartum depression. And you're like, oh, I know that if I answer anything on this Edinburgh scale, postpartum depression scale, that I have postpartum depression, you're going to take my baby. So what? You're going to call somebody and then I'm going to be labeled as crazy. Like the literal worst thing you could do for a mom already suffering from postpartum depression is ask her to take that scale, in my opinion, at the doctor. Yeah.
Do you find yourself bursting out in tears?
Yeah. And like, does it, I'm sorry. Like, and then looking at that survey and being like, is this to imply that not everyone is doing this?
Right. My doctor was like,
this is the first time learning.
I did answer that correctly. And they were just like, your hormones are balancing.
Oh, I mean, if it makes anybody feel better, I had 2 degrees at that point in social work. I also worked as a hospital social worker answering the calls and the referrals for postpartum depressive mothers in the hospital for almost 8 years at that point. Still was like, nope, I'm just a piece of shit. Postpartum depression never entered my brain because it is that thing of good fucking luck. Yeah, you're just fucking not working hard enough. You're not buying the right baby products. You're not, you know, doing the right thing. You're like, you're not doing it right.
Right. But like if you looked at this, what this person was saying with a different lens of, I wish that this grief was normalized. Like, I wish this grief was normalized in a way that radicalized us.
Yes. I love that.
I like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Not so normalized to settle for it.
Right. Right. And I think that maybe to your point about like, I feel like they're going to take my baby instead of like, okay, I mean, we can go down a whole rabbit hole about like the foster care system and stuff at that point where it's like, oh, so you're saying this person can't care for their child and you're going to force them to like pay the state and do parenting classes when really what they need is like stable housing and to not be back at work 10 days later because they don't have leave.
Yep. Yeah. And having that, I was going to say that I hadn't ever needed, like, I mean, clearly that was my first kid. I was working a job at that time. The way I was like, I don't know under what circumstance I would have learned differently, but the way I had no idea how little time I had at home with my kid before I was supposed to go back to work. And then I just like straight up told them, like, at that point I was going into an empty office. I wasn't seeing anybody and I had access to our system on the computer. And I was like, I'm doing this at home. Like, I'll go into the office if you want me to be physically present like 2 days a week, but I'm only going for 4 hours because no one comes to that office. So, but like the way that like that first experience, like dealing with, you know, EDD and filing for, you know, leave and all of this stuff, I was just like, this is the most complicated shit I've ever encountered. I don't know why. I just gave birth. Why am I having to hop through all these hoops and be on the phone for 4 hours with a machine to try and get this situated? Like it was a very cold, hard reality at 26 years old to be trying to figure that out.
That's, I mean, and I don't think that is talked about enough is like the paperwork. Mm-hmm. I remember panicking. I remember being swamped with paperwork and in the hospital, like how many days do I have to get my baby enrolled in our health insurance?
Can you see both? And I mean, if you're watching the video, you can see both of us. Like, we're both moving.
Tensing up, yeah. Well, that I've brought it up before, but I got laid off. So my second baby, I gave birth in June. And so I was teaching a full school year and I had to use up 10 of my sick days in order for FMLA to go into. And even then I worked there for 9 months because it's a school year and I couldn't get the full 12 months of leave. So I like timed this pregnancy the best I could so that I would have the summer and then I could come back in the fall. Anyway, so like 5 days before my due date, I was like, okay, I'm going to start taking my sick days. And 5 days in, baby's still not there. It's like on my right around my due date. I get the call from my principal that says, budget cut your position for next year. Just letting you know. So sorry. And it was a whole, like, it happens in Chicago public schools all the time because it was a special education position and those are dependent on enrollment. So like, I knew it was a risk. I didn't think it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Especially when I was on maternity leave, essentially.
Truly.
But I remember I was like, okay, so do you think that the position's going to get appealed for and come back? And he's like, we won't find that out until August. And so I was like, well, I'm going to give birth.
Right.
And so
yeah,
if I'm gonna go through
this really major transition. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, am I going to have insurance? I'm essentially fired as of June. So yeah, like, is my insurance gone? He was like, oh, you can check into COBRA. And I was like, but if I get another job in Chicago Public Schools before August, then am I covered? It was such a fucking nightmare. I had to, I gave birth June 14th and I interviewed and accepted a position 10 days later in my fucking diaper because we needed insurance. Like, I was emailing from my bed at the hospital because I was like, I have to set up interviews because if I don't, I don't know what's going to happen.
Right. Because if I don't,
it's like, how do you expect people to not have a fucking, and like, that's, I have housing, I have food, I have a paycheck.
Right. Right. Yeah.
That, and people, I'm 8 steps ahead in privilege in that circumstance. Right. And people are just like, I don't know how many days I can take off to heal from my major abdominal surgery C-section. Like, I go serve coffee.
Right. Right. And that's the thing too, is that it's like, to be like, I was very privileged also to be able to have that, the leave situation, and to have that hit me in the face for the first time when I was 26 and, you know, experience that kind of like worry and insecurity was very privileged. And the demands on, and that, like, that attitude that you're talking about with, like, with admin, where it's like, well, I don't know, we won't know until August. And you're like, are you hearing me? Like, this isn't like a matter where the attitude for everyone except the person who's experiencing it is like, well, I don't know, we'll see. And you're like, no, this is my life. What are you talking about? And you're not the only one. Like, this is a systemic issue.
I mean, that immediately spiraled me into that being laid off from that position, being like, oh, my humanity doesn't matter. Then the fall was 20. And so I worked for 6 months until the pandemic hit, all of the childcare was gone. Again, nobody gave a fuck about the humanity of anyone who is caregiving. And it's just gone on since then. It was just like one thing after the next of like, oh, wait, none of these systems give a fuck. And as an educator, thinking that this was the one place I could be taken care of in a female dominated field focuses on care.
Yep. Nope. Humanity not recognized. Like, well,
no,
you'll figure it out.
That's, like, that's the grief. I don't want to be like, oh, wake up call. Life sucks.
Right.
There's grief, but a different kind.
Right. Let it radicalize you and move you forward. Absolutely.
Yeah. Any last thoughts?
System's fucked. No, this was, I love taking these responses and like talking about them and discussing them. I feel like it's a very, all of these questions are so vulnerable and open. And so I appreciate all of those responses.
Yeah. The anonymous, I think maybe we can come up with one and post it soon.
Throw it
on
up in
Instagram.
Our stories.
If you're not following us on Instagram, that's a great place to get a hold of us and get updates and things like that, because we have some events coming up and things like that, and including an in-person one in Chicago. So please keep an eye out on our social media and get more information if you're in Chicago.
Absolutely. We'd love to see you. Yeah. Awesome. Right. Thank you guys so much. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us on another episode of Time to Lean. Your questions and stories are what keep us going. So keep those voicemails and messages coming.
Until our next episode, remember that you can always find us on social media and, of course, in your podcast feed. You can also subscribe for $5 a month on Spotify for uninterrupted episodes and bonus content.
We're so grateful for your support. See you next time.